Friday, December 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, India's Prime Minister makes a surprise visit to Pakistan. Our South Asia correspondent tells us why Narendra Modi is trying to improve India's troubled relations with its neighbor. The Central African Republic delays its national election yet again. A human rights researcher speaks to us about whether the vote can help to end the country's sectarian violence. And we'll look back at a tumultuous year for the U.S. Republican Party in Congress. It's all ahead on International Edition. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has arrived in Pakistan to meet with his counterpart Nawaz Sharif on a previously unannounced visit to India's rival neighbor, the first such visit by an Indian Prime Minister in 12 years. I spoke earlier with our South Asia correspondent Ayaz Ghul in the Pakistani capital Islamabad, and I asked him why Modi is making this visit now.
As you know, that this breakthrough, in fact, occurred in Paris when the two leaders, the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and the Indian counterpart Narendra Modi, they met on the sidelines and decided to resume bilateral contacts. And then we saw that the Indian foreign minister was able to come to Islamabad earlier this month to attend the Heart of Asia conference that primarily discussed how to promote peace and economic prosperity in Afghanistan. So this is a continuation of that process that we see that on his way back from Afghanistan today, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has decided to make this brief stopover in the eastern Pakistani city of Lahore, where he has just landed and he has come out of the plane, and Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is at the airport and has received him.
Well, what is the ultimate goal of the leaders of these two countries meeting? Is it actually to resume formal peace talks?
Well, I think the two countries are under pressure, especially from the United States and other international partners, to join hands and promote peace in Afghanistan. I think that is what has brought the two countries together, because with continuing instability in Afghanistan, there are worries that if the tension, the traditional tensions between Pakistan and Afghanistan, worsen in the meantime, it will become really a challenge for the international community, which has been trying hard to bring peace to Afghanistan. But if there is tension in this part of South Asia, then obviously, there are allegations that India and Pakistan, in order to increase their influence in Afghanistan, are engaged in some sort of a proxy war there. And that has what worried Afghanistan's international backers and donors, that maybe that conflict should not be allowed to take place on the Afghan soil. Otherwise, things will become much more difficult. So that seems to be the primary objective, because there is also an effort on part of the United States, China, to promote regional connectivity through sort of energy links and, bringing gas from Central Asian regions. And recently, we saw that four nations, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India together, they inaugurated the construction of this gas pipeline, which will bring gas to Pakistan and then onward to India through Afghanistan from Turkmenistan. So it seems that the economic concerns and using those economic priorities and using them to bring peace to Afghanistan is what, bringing India and Pakistan closer. In terms of dealing with terrorism, as India has long complained that Pakistani-based Islamist militants have been conducting terrorist activities on Indian soil, that remains a challenge for both the countries to deal with. There are serious differences. But we saw the breakthrough that occurred earlier this month was that India agreed to discuss the Kashmir dispute with Pakistan, which Pakistan has long wanted to discuss with India. And at the same time, Pakistan agreed to discuss Indian concerns regarding terrorism originating from what Indians say the Pakistani soil.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our South Asia correspondent, Ayaz Ghul, in Islamabad.
Thank you.
And for a quick look at social media, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on Twitter. His handle is @NarendraModi, and he did tweet about his visit to Pakistan. This is what he tweeted a couple of hours ago. He said, looking forward to meeting Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in Lahore today afternoon, where I will drop by on my way back to Delhi. In another tweet, he also said that he spoke to Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and wished him well on his birthday. Narendra Modi has 16 million followers on Twitter. Again, if you want to find him, he is at Narendra Modi. You can find this show on Twitter as well. We are at VOA_IE. And I'm on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
A smartphone, a really smartphone, that will be able to diagnose malaria. Engineers at Texas A&M University are developing a device that attaches to a smartphone and converts it into a sophisticated microscope. Here's Texas A&M's Richard Cote.
The way they diagnose malaria now is with a microscope, but it's a big benchtop microscope, and you have to have the facilities for that scope. So basically what we're taking is that gold standard and making it into a portable device.
The device uses polarized light on a blood sample to detect malaria parasites, and a diagnosis takes just minutes using a phone app. Some 214 million people got malaria in 2015, killing over 400,000, most of those in sub-Saharan Africa. The cost of the device will be under $50, according to the developers. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Authorities in the Central African Republic have ordered a three-day delay in a national election designed to replace a transitional government and bring stability to a country racked by years of sectarian violence. The election, which has been delayed several times before, was originally scheduled for this Sunday. It is now due to take place on Wednesday. The CAR's National Election Authority called for the new delay to deal with technical and organizational difficulties. Well, ahead of the move, Lewis Mudge, a human rights researcher in Nairobi, discussed the CAR's election process with VOA's Victor Beatty. Mudge said that whenever the vote is held, it will be only a first step towards stability.
The elections in of themselves are not going to simply bring about an end to the conflict. It's going to have to be a more long-term process. It's going to have to incorporate issues about holding perpetrators of serious crimes accountable. There has to be real reconciliation efforts made across the sectarian divide between Muslims and non-Muslims. And there needs to be a meaningful development program set up in the country so people have a reason to be hopeful again. Good that the elections are happening. Good that the run-up has been peaceful thus far, more or less. But they're not going to be a silver bullet in of themselves. They're not going to simply solve very deep-rooted problems in the Central African Republic.
The voters face some 30 presidential candidates. Will anyone emerge, in your view, that can actually lead the country into a transition?
There's a few people that are emerging as the front runners. They're gaining support both from key international countries, but also from people with influence, such as the former president, François Bozizé. There's also going to be legislative elections on the same day, so people will be voting for their deputies who will represent them in parliament. There's a new Senate that's been established by the new constitution, and there's a real concern amongst voters that they just don't understand what people's platforms are, because there's been a very short campaign, and with the security situation, candidates just simply can't get out around the country. So a lot of people will be voting blind.
Well, there's no doubt this is among the poorest countries on earth. What is the priority, especially in the effort to disarm these militia?
Disarmament has not stopped. There are, for the first time in the Central African Republic in a long time, there are actually more internally displaced people than actual refugees outside the country. So we're looking at about 25% of the country is either internally displaced or a refugee. And as you said, this is definitely one of the poorest countries in the world. A key aspect is going to be to stop the violence, is going to be disarmament. This is a country where small arms proliferate, where it's very easy to get Kalashnikovs and grenades. And the fact of the matter is that disarmament has not really started. I think what's most important to stop the violence and to let people actually start to live their lives will be to hold individuals accountable for serious crimes, to pass a message and to send that message to future people who want to commit human rights abuses, future warlords, that if they start to kill, if they start to rape, if they start to burn villages, they will be held accountable.
And that was human rights researcher Lewis Mudge speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. As 2015 draws to a close, China's slowing economy is affecting the world in significant ways, as seen earlier in the year with the impact of China devaluing its currency, the renminbi. New York University professor and China economics expert Anne Li spoke earlier with my colleague Jim Stevenson and gave her assessment of where the Chinese economy is heading in the coming year.
Certainly, the slowdown in Europe and the U.S. has probably accelerated certain plans the Chinese had anyway. These things were goals that they had set out that they were probably going to try to meet. But given the accelerated slowdowns in Europe and then in the U.S., Chinese leaders were basically saying, well, it would make sense to ask folks to provide tax incentives and other areas, other forms of policy tools to increase investments. So that was basically what I was suggesting, that it's a little bit of both something internal and external going on, and it's not necessarily bad news for the world.
You've written about Beijing's efforts to grow the middle class. Are increased wages helping to boost the internal market economy?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're on track to continue to lift more people out of poverty as long as their economy continues to grow. And the indicators for consumption growth and income growth seem to be accelerating. So I think that this is good news for both China in terms of, you know, creating more stability if they have a larger middle class, and good news for the rest of the world so that you have basically expanding demand around the world. And this can only be good news for a lot of private companies when they are trying to make decisions on whether they're going to start a company or start a new product line. If they know that there are more customers on the other end, they're more likely to make those investments.
The latest Asia-Pacific Wealth Report indicates that Asia's wealthy now outnumbers those here in North America. What factors are involved in this shift?
I am certain that it's because there are more and more people being able to create more private companies to generate their own profits and then become wealthy that way. Remember, 30 years ago, this whole nation was state-owned, so everything was state-owned enterprises. There were no such thing as private companies. And now the private sector is, roughly half of the economy, and the other half is still state-owned. But I think this trend towards more privatization will continue. And it's already also outlined in the five-year plan that they want to introduce more competition in certain industries. And so I think when they do that, that just creates a wealth of opportunity for individuals to create businesses and make a lot of money.
Anne Li is an internationally recognized leading authority on China's economic relations. She's the author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China, and she's also an adjunct professor of economics and finance at New York University. Anne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
And Anne Li was speaking to my colleague Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
If you want to wake up and stay in a good mood all day long, a new study from researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine suggests that you need to get a good night's sleep. Now, that's not necessarily a lot of sleep, but some good quality uninterrupted sleep. The researchers found that being roused from sleep several times a night puts a damper on a good mood more than having a small amount of sleep without any interruptions. Patrick Finnan, the study's lead author and an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins, says that when your sleep is disrupted throughout the night, you don't have the chance to go through each of the needed various phases of sleep. Not progressing through the stages of sleep can deprive you of the needed slow-wave sleep that is necessary to making a person feel refreshed and restored. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition with Michael Lippin. It's time for a look back at the year in U.S. congressional politics. Our congressional correspondent, Cindy Sain, joined me in the studio earlier to talk about that. And I started by asking her why 2015 was such a turbulent year for Congress's majority Republicans.
Well, they found themselves having the majority in both chambers, and there were high expectations, and they sort of said, okay, now we're going to really be able to get our priorities through. We're going to get legislation done. And there was so much infighting, particularly on the House side. We have about 40 very conservative members that call themselves the House Freedom Caucus, and they gave a very hard time to House Speaker John Boehner, who was more of a sort of middle-of-the-road moderate conservative. And there were battles where almost a government shut down, and Speaker Boehner had his high point when the Pope came and addressed a joint meeting of Congress. And he being a devout Catholic, it was just a wonderful day for him. And the next day, he shocked the world by resigning.
Well, what were the major battles that prompted Boehner to actually step down?
Well, there were battles over immigration issues. There were battles over child refugees coming from Central American countries at the border, this kind of thing. That was Planned Parenthood, which is a health care for women in the U.S., more ideological battles on social issues and immigration.
Well, what were the Republicans' major achievements for 2015? Because it wasn't all bad for them, was it?
It wasn't all bad. And sort of Congress as a whole went out on a high note, passing a massive spending bill, funding the government. Both sides had things that they liked about that. There was a lift on the ban on oil exports. Republicans liked. Democrats got more money for domestic programs like medical research. So both sides claim victory on that one.
And how about the main frustrations? Let's start with the Republicans, who are the majority in both houses.
Right. They had the majority, but they were still not able to stop the Iran nuclear deal, which was signed, and they opposed bitterly. They weren't able to stop that because of the Senate. And on the other side, Democrats were also frustrated because they can't even get some of their main points up for a vote, like immigration, comprehensive immigration reform.
What about the Obamacare law, the health care law that provides Americans with greater access to insurance? What happened in Congress this year on that law?
Right. Well, the House, I think, has voted 50-some times to repeal or get rid of certain parts of it, and it still has not happened. The Senate has also been voting recently, but it's basically has not gone anywhere. It hasn't reached the president's desk.
What's going to happen next year in Congress, do you think, as we get underway in January with a new session?
Right. Well, I mentioned that Speaker Boehner resigned, and there's a new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who is younger. He has these conservative House Freedom Caucus members behind him, at least for now, and he's promising a more confident America and saying that he's going to involve the members more, get their input, and really be able to offer an alternative to President Obama and the Democrats, possibly Hillary Clinton.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our congressional correspondent, Cindy Sain, for updating us on the year in Congress.
Thank you.
Well, 2015 was a big year also for IMAX and 3D movie technology, with almost all big-budget movie productions being offered to cinemagoers in both formats. VOA's Penelope Pulu has this look at some of those films.
Nothing will stand in our way. I will finish what you started.
It's no secret, and even less of a surprise, that Star Wars: The Force Awakens broke the record for the biggest box office debut weekend globally, with ticket sales of $529 million. And that does not include the Chinese markets, where the film debuts on January 9th. According to Zarth Birch, director of theaters and entertainment at Smithsonian, many moviegoers are happy to pay more to watch the film on huge IMAX screens for an all-immersive experience.
They've created this incredible world, and it's this fantasy world that is so endless, so engaging. Of course, it spans multiple generations. I think that IMAX is particularly relevant with the 70mm experience.
And it is not just Star Wars. Before J.J. Abrams' sci-fi blockbuster swept the box office, Jurassic World, the latest in Universal's dinosaur franchise, opened this summer in IMAX and 3D, stomping the competition. On its first weekend, it grossed a breathtaking $525 million. A studio invests in IMAX and 3D formats when it can predict huge profits. Famous movie franchises such as Avengers are a sure bet. Movie lovers prefer to watch high-octane action flicks on huge screens instead of their TV sets. Avengers: Age of Ultron has so far grossed close to $1.5 billion worldwide. The Hunger Games final installment in IMAX and 3D is also among the top grossing films of the year. Pixar's animated IMAX 3D films, The Good Dinosaur and Inside Out, were among this year's top earners, attracting families with their witty scripts, wonderful colors, and masterful animation. But not all IMAX films are successful. Ron Howard's whale of a film, In the Heart of the Sea, about the sinking of the American whaling ship Essex in 1820, an event that inspired the novel Moby Dick, was shot down by the critics as a tale without a soul. This is a good example how the thrill of a story can be lost in the visual extravaganza and technical details. Still, IMAX and 3D formats will continue to do well, offering bigger, brighter, and better stories on huge theater screens. Penelope Kulu, VOA News, Washington.
On IMAX 3D this weekend, and I can't wait. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Diane Gao. The engineer was John Dryden. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many conflicts worldwide, human trafficking or modern slavery is often among the most tragic consequences. And despite persistent efforts to eradicate trafficking in persons, this abhorrent crime persists. According to the International Labor Organization, over 20 million people worldwide are victims of forced labor. On September 16th, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations and December President of the Security Council, Samantha Power, stated that for groups like ISIL and Boko Haram, slavery has become one of their most versatile weapons of war, used to instill fear, to inflict suffering, to recruit followers, reward fighters, convert people of other faiths, reward combatants, and generate revenue. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL distributes women and girls to fighters as spoils of war, systematically rapes them, and sells them in markets like cattle. ISIL has even gone so far as to encourage the sexual assault of prepubescent girls and issue guidelines on how to treat the women and girls who have been enslaved. Boko Haram also exacts horrors upon those whom it has kidnapped and enslaved. On October 2nd, the group reportedly forced four girls and a boy to become suicide bombers in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, where they self-detonated at a mosque during evening prayers. 15 people, including these kids, were killed, and more than 35 were injured. Witnesses estimated that the bombers were as young as 9 years old. Member states must commit to ending the conflicts that enable human traffickers to operate, as well as support trafficking victims. To address this in Iraq and Syria, where ISIL has enshrined systems of human trafficking and sexual violence, the U.S.-led 65-member coalition remains determined to destroy ISIL, stem the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, and restrict its funding streams used to fuel its reign of terror. The U.S. also continues to provide security and counterterrorism assistance to the governments of Chad, Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin to aid their fight against Boko Haram. Human trafficking in conflict is a scourge that knows no borders. That's why U.N. member states must individually combat human trafficking and coordinate efforts now to put a stop to this human tragedy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.